Victor knows the fine details of insuring firms like yours. For over 60 years, Victor has provided outstanding service and broad, flexible, and innovative professional liability solutions to engineering firms and ACEC members. As a Victor insured, you have access to free, on-demand continuing education courses, automated contract reviews, and endless risk management tools and resources to help manage projects and grow your business. Visit www.victorinsuranceus.com/ACEC to learn more.
Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by Victor Insurance Managers, one of the largest and most experienced underwriting managers of professional liability and specialty insurance programs in the world. Professional liability costs are among the largest expenditures for engineering firms, and effectively managing that expenditure is not necessarily just a case of finding the lowest rates. At the fall conference, Darren S. Black and Kreton Pantelidis of Risk Strategies presented a program on the economics of E&O, and we caught up with them there to talk about how firms can best manage their professional liability expenditures. Welcome to you both.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
So you reported that there's a firming in the professional liability market. Why is that, and what impact does that have on firms?
Well, I would say that it's much less within the professional liability market than some other lines. D&O, cyber, commercial auto, umbrella, they're seeing a hard market. And the kind of the point of the program that we did today was how firms can effectively immunize themselves from a firming in the market that is the result, frankly, of social inflation, of low interest rates, which impact insurers' underwriting profits, and some other issues that are causing firms to either increase their rates, not to the extent as with other lines, but certainly decreasing capacity. So there's a no longer a willingness to put up unlimited $1 million of limit for a specific risk, and they're coming down, and that is impacting insureds in terms of their ability to get the capacity. They're having to talk to more than one insurer, certainly in some instances, many different insurers.
You mentioned social inflation. What is that?
A variety of factors that in this time frame we probably can't address, but simply a number of circumstances that have combined to create what one might refer to as runaway jury verdicts. Much more significant damage awards than we've seen historically. And although very few professional liability claims against engineers and architects actually get tried to a jury, those verdicts certainly influence the amounts for which a given claim can be settled. So obviously with higher settlement amounts affecting underwriters' profitability, they're having to pass some of those costs on in terms of higher rates and higher premiums that this client constituency is having to pay.
In your program, you talked about underwriting credits and debits. How do those work, and how can a firm have any impact on those?
Underwriting credits and debits was really the crux of our program. It is a given going in that if all you do is submit an application with the numbers requested within the application and the yes or no answers to those questions, which everybody understands underwriters what they want the answer to be, all of those things trigger either underwriting credits, which result in a firm paying less money, or debits, depending upon the riskiness, the exposure inherent to a given project type or discipline. What we were trying to convey was that a firm should recognize what those exposures are, whether project types, discipline, geographic factors, etc., that will cause underwriters to pay more, unless there's a story behind those numbers that calls the underwriter's attention to the fact that the firm, in recognition of heightened risk of whether it's a condo exposure or wastewater treatment plants, K-12 education, knowing that they might otherwise charge more, what is the firm doing in recognition of those heightened exposures in order to mitigate those exposures? And if they have that story, we can often offset the debits and actually get discretionary credits applied.
So I'll jump in and just add a point about a specific credit that firms can get. A lot of times design firms will drive better design, not because they want to lower risk, but because they want to do more business with their clients and they want to be better designers. And so if your firm is particularly good at a technical issue, for example, having a really efficient core so that you can have a higher leasable square footage and provide that to your developer, or clear span so there's no columns and people can get these great views. Work with your broker to emphasize that, because an underwriter is going to want to hear that you know how to do that really, really well. Because in addition to the business benefit, you're a better risk because of it, because you're an expert in that specialty area.
Specialization is certainly one of those factors that can offset the debits and therefore the higher rates that we were talking about.
Yeah, you mentioned that they don't like to see firms that dabble. You use that term, that sort of dabble in a variety of disciplines.
Sure. Stay in your lane. Okay. Right? They want to see firms that only accept project types that are in their area of specialization. They know that client base. They know the expectations. And more importantly, they have the technical expertise in order to really wrap their arms around it and try to manage budget, sequence, and schedule to the best of their ability.
If you've never done it before, there will be a perception that you don't know what you're doing, fair or not.
Right. Which is probably fair. So an effective structure involves more than just getting the best possible rate. You made that point that while you want to get a great rate, it's not necessarily the most effective thing to do. You talked about putting together like a complete underwriting submission. What does that involve?
Well, I think we've been speaking to it, right? It starts with a recognition of what an underwriter will otherwise assume makes a firm too risky in order to get even average rates, much less preferred rates, or terms and conditions, the breadth of the wording, expanding the coverage that other firms can get by manuscripting that wording might allow a firm to take on a contract, a project that another firm couldn't because they've got broader coverage. They know they can transfer that risk to their insurers. They're only going to get that if they've convinced their underwriters that they are, in fact, a specialist, that have the right centralized protocols in place to make sure they're managing all of those areas that might otherwise give rise to severity-prone claims, if you will.
Is that when we talk about something like that, are we talking like a thick book, or are we talking...
No.
No.
An application alone might be 2, 3, 4 pages. A loss run might add a page or two to that. We're talking about maybe doubling that size.
Okay.
And providing a narrative, bringing the attention of the underwriters to the specialization, to the talent in terms of risk management that resides within the firm, and the centralized policies and procedures. The one thing that can expand upon that is if the firm has had a negative claims history, there might be a lot of explanation in terms of lessons learned, in terms of what went into the decision to settle a given claim for a given amount. That can actually take a little bit of time, and that's why we might actually double the size of just an application and a loss run.
You mentioned if a firm has a claim, and it may be a big one, what are the steps that it can take to sort of mitigate that and to get back in the good graces of the insurers?
Yeah, so... let's assume it is a big claim, and it's going to be clear that there was some responsibility, right? If the design firm, for example, is paying the most out of any other defendant, it's going to be hard to convince your underwriter that you didn't do anything wrong in future years. So the big question is, how are you diffusing that knowledge, what happened on that claim, to the rest of the people at the firm, right? Because there's an argument that can be made that you are a better firm for having gone through that. So did you change any contractual protocols? Are you choosing your clients differently? How are you doing peer reviews? Right? Is there going to be a more senior person, perhaps, on those higher prone exposure projects, taking a look at the design before it goes out? These are the types of things that you should emphasize with your underwriter in a succinct way after a claim to show that it's not going to happen again, or the likelihood of it happening again is reduced.
And that's something you'd work with your broker to do, to sort of get it in the right language and everything?
Sure. We think this is a collaborative process, right? We don't have the information. The insured does. It's our job to try to pull that out of an insured's risk management department, whether it's a general counsel, CFO, you name it. We can only share with the insured what the underwriter community, what the reaction will be in the absence of that type of explanation, whether it's a lesson learned or the mitigating circumstances that went into the decision to settle it for that amount, and the impact that it can have on the program structure and the rate, as you mentioned, if they do it versus if they don't do it. And usually it's very, very well worth their time.
You recommend perhaps carrying a bigger retention, which to my mind, is that a deductible or is that something different?
At some level, a deductible crosses over a threshold at which it becomes a self-insured retention.
Okay.
That tends to be around $250,000, but it varies. Mm-hmm. It's actually a term of art, but probably the subject of another discussion.
Okay. But you recommend carrying a bigger one, perhaps even you mentioned like figuring out what you expected your claims to be over maybe 5 years and self-insuring that amount. And why?
Well, I think I mentioned during the program itself that insurers make money off the time value of money,
mm-hmm.
on the float between the time they take in the premium dollars and they pay the claims out. In this instance, that's a long tail exposure, so years pass between those two incidents, meaning that for the vast majority of firms, the idea of trading dollars with an insurance company is a losing proposition. So if you can retain the risk of the claims that you can anticipate and that happen on a regular basis, leaving your insurance for those catastrophic losses that you don't want to anticipate and that might otherwise affect the ability of the firm to handle things like bonus pools and the traction and retention of talent, you're avoiding that trading of dollars other than when absolutely necessary. And over time, your premium savings and the breadth of terms and conditions you can get by not frequently involving your insurer in your losses can have benefits. It's more of a strategic approach than just taking the lowest mm-hmm. deductible offer.
And even if you are covering it, covering those losses yourself or those claims yourself, are you reporting them to the insurance company and letting them know you're doing this? Or is that something you're keeping to yourself?
No, you're reporting claims, period. If they get closed out within the retention, you're not going to be penalized for it.
Okay.
The danger is that if you can't close it out within the retention, your failure to report it on a timely basis may result in a declination of coverage when you need it the most.
Okay. How often should a firm shop for professional liability insurance?
So we would recommend on average every 3 to 5 years. Now, if you have a very good relationship with your claims team at the particular insurer and the underwriting team, and you know the terms are exceptionally competitive, sometimes you can extend that process, right? But I think 3 to 5 years is a good benchmark. If you're not doing it every 3 to 5 years, there should be a reason why, and you should be able to articulate that reason.
The counterpoint to that is we also think that you should always be ready to approach other markets should the incumbent create the need to do so. So we suggest doing a full underwriting submission every year just in case it sends a message to the incumbent that they need to stay on their toes, that you're ready to approach other markets should circumstances dictate.
But you don't, in that case, you send it to the incumbent, and if everything's okay, that's the end of the picture. But if it's not okay, then you send it to others.
You have the opportunity to retain this account if we get terms within the following parameters within the next 2 weeks. We still got a good month or so before renewal. And if they can't meet that dictate, then yes, we will approach other markets.
And finally, you recommended meeting with the underwriter during the shopping process. What does that achieve?
Yeah, so as a former insured, I can say I always wanted to meet at least the underwriters and claims teams that were being seriously considered. You're not going to go out and meet every single, you know, market in the A&E space when you're shopping or, you know, your PL a particular year. But when you've done the proper underwriting submission and worked with your broker and narrowed things down to 3 or 4 maybe potential lead markets, it's just a totally different relationship when they know who you are. You can answer the questions directly. They get a feel for your personality. You can go out and have dinner with them. It just makes the business relationship of ultimately paying claims, which is what you want them to do, much easier.
The unfortunate reality is you probably have to be a firm of a certain size in order to have that opportunity. If you have that opportunity, you should absolutely take advantage of it. Learning from that prospective insurer who's put out competitive terms talking with them about their approach to dispute resolution, for example, can be invaluable. But more importantly, they know that that underwriting submission coming from us, we know what the underwriters want to hear. So their opportunity to actually ask questions of the insured and have it come back from the source, it really resonates and often results in even better terms than the ones that got them into that finalist position in the first place.
You mentioned just one more. You mentioned dispute resolution, and I wrote that down when I was in your session, that you said that sometimes their dispute resolution is more important than the rate.
What you're buying is the promise to pay claims.
Uh-huh.
And if one insurer is willing to take into account your relationships with a client that you want to be to keep intact despite the fact that you've got a dispute on a particular project, those kinds of things can be invaluable in terms of the overall relationship. And we have a lot of firms that so appreciate the approach to dispute resolution that a given insurer has exhibited that they will renew with that insurer even in the presence of a 10%+ premium difference as compared to what another carrier with basically the same policy terms and conditions might be offering. So yes, dispute resolution, that's where the rubber meets the road.
Great. Well, I appreciate you guys taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.